These days, our phones are the key to all our digital data. Crack the password, you get instant access to bank accounts, emails, all sorts of personal information. But how can we build a better password? You know, that's what we're talking a lot about with phones, the best kind of password. Well, the future personalized password might be right inside your own body. Smartphones, think of it, they have print fingerprint scanners. Companies have been looking at everything from retinal scans to heart rhythm trackers. But what about your brain? Your brain has a lot of electrical stuff going on there. Brain prints, using your brain waves as an identifier. Harder to hack than a fingerprint. And researchers at Binghamton University are studying how you could create these brain prints. My next guest is part of that team. Sarah Laszlo is an assistant professor of psychology at Binghamton University in Binghamton, New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Wow, brain prints. How do you create a brain print?
Very carefully.
You stole my line.
Yeah, sorry. What we do is we bring people into our lab and we connect a bunch of sensors to their heads so we can non-invasively measure their brain activity. And then we show them a whole bunch of images, rapid fire, one after another. And each of the images is sort of designed to elicit a very unique response from person to person. Mm-hmm. And once we have about a half an hour worth of their brain data, we can submit that data to a computer, and then the computer is able to sort of process the brain data and then figure out who is who.
So if you showed me a picture, I would have the same brain print all the time.
We don't use a single picture because the response to any single image, it changes too much and it's too noisy. So we use an average of about between 25 to 50 pictures.
And how accurate has this become?
100%.
Let me hear that again. I've never heard anything work 100%. You know.
I know. It's 100% accurate in a pool of 50 people to a period of up to 10 months. And that's the limits that we've pushed it to so far.
Well, you know, when you have anything like this and you say it works 100%, immediately the hackers in the room are going to say, I can break that.
Absolutely.
So I guess part of your job then is to try to figure out the weakness.
So immediately, immediately as soon as we got it to work, like the very next lab meeting was, okay, we got it to work. Now how do we hack into it? And so we're trying a whole bunch of different hacks. The engineers on the team have some computational hacks they're working on, but I'm not one of the engineers. I'm a psychologist. So the hack that I've been working on is the trying to figure out how possible it is for a malicious person, a hacker, to train their brain to impersonate the brain activity of someone else to sneak into a brain biometric system.
It's sort of like changing your fingerprints or your face or something, but you're changing your brain.
Yeah, so it's sort of the brain equivalent of maybe putting on a fake latex fingerprint to fool a fingerprint scanner.
And how easy is it?
It's not easy. So far, we have trained, we call them our brain hackers. We have given them up to 12 hours of brain hack training, and we've only gotten them to be able to become about 10% more similar to their target than they were when they started. And they need to get to be about 40% more similar on average than they started. So it's 12 hours isn't enough, at least.
Mm-hmm. Does my brain print change over the course of a day if I'm hungry or sleepy or cranky or something else?
It probably changes a little bit, but the computer algorithms that we use are sophisticated enough that minor fluctuations don't break the identification system. And like I said, that is true up to a period of 10 months. So even though your brain activity obviously changes day to day, at least for a time span of that long, it doesn't change enough to break the computing system that identifies people.
Now, with 100% accuracy, where do you go from here?
I know. I kept telling my grad student, I don't know what you're going to do now because you're never going to be able to beat yourself. But most of it is towards trying to make the system that acquires the brain data cheaper and faster now.
Okay, so, yeah, okay, give me a setup of how you collect. Do I have to put that cap on with a lot of electrodes and things? Before you get that answer, let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. talking about brainwaves and brain prints with Sarah Laszlo. She's an assistant professor at, is that SUNY Binghamton or is that the University of Binghamton?
It is a SUNY, but they tell us that we should call it Binghamton University.
I went to SUNY Buffalo, and I so I can call it. Yes, so I can call it SUNY Binghamton if you don't mind.
You can call it whatever you want.
Okay.
But I will get in trouble if I call it anything
okay,
but Binghamton University.
Okay, I know they do the same thing in Buffalo. So tell me, is it a cap, one of these typical things with all the wires coming out that we see?
Yeah, right now it is. And so one of the challenges is to make it not like that, because, of course, nobody wants to put that on every time they want to get into their computer. So one of our prototype devices that we're testing has the sensors embedded in Google Glass. So you just put the Google Glass on and it has the sensors in it, and then it does the identification in the onboard processor on the smartphone that the Google Glass is paired with.
Just with the Google Glasses?
Yeah, with the Google Glasses.
So you don't need the whole brain, you just need a part of the brain.
Right. Even with the data we collected with the whole head worth of sensors, we found that we only needed about 5 of them in order to get the 100% accuracy.
And which part of the brain do you stick this Google Glasses around?
So the Google Glasses just go on like Google Glasses normally would. So when we do that, the active sensors are sort of over the temples. The sensors that we used in the published study with 100% accuracy were placed over the back of the head. So that's one of the challenges with the Google Glass, is that it only gives us access to the front of the head, and that's not where the best sort of classification data came from.
But you see what you've done here. You've given Google Glass a reason to be reinvigorated.
A reason to live.
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
You should be hearing from Google like in 5 minutes, I would think.
I was at Google in September or October, actually.
You're way ahead of me on this one.
Yeah, or they are. They're pretty smart over there.
Yeah. So I mean, if you can get Google Glass to come up with a way of, you know, identifying.
Yeah. That would be the greatest miracle, is finding something to do that's useful with Google Glass.
And just think, have you started a company or anything? If you're going to start talking business, is SUNY going to be involved in this?
We do have one patent that exists, and we have another one that's pending. But we haven't started a company yet. We're scientists, and so we don't know how to do that.
That's where the lawyers come in, you know.
Yeah, and fortunately, SUNY does have a lot of good lawyers that are there to help us out, and they've been very helpful.
So we might see this bearing fruition, you know, not too. I mean, you must have competitors, right?
No, we're the first lab worldwide to accomplish 100% brain biometric accuracy with the particular technique that we use. So not really.
Wow.
Which is nice.
So you're just sitting back and waiting for something new to happen now.
Yeah, we're sitting back and waiting to find out whether the NSF is going to give us more money. That's what we're really waiting for.
No, that would be small bucks compared to what Google could.
That's true.
I can see why.
That's absolutely true.
You're going out there. You know, is there anything, you know, physically that you could hack into the Google Glass, if not the brain?
Yeah, so you could hack into, of course, the computer that is holding, say, the reference brain prints, and you could alter, say, the target's reference to be your own reference, or you could steal the reference so that you can feed it back into the computer. Those kinds of hacks are the things that my collaborators in engineering are working on, and I only know what they've told me about that.
Yeah.
But apparently, we have a paper that they're preparing where they've used some techniques from image processing, in particular steganography, to be able to identify when a sort of reference brain print has been stolen and fed back into the system. And they're about, last time I checked, they're about 70-80% successful in identifying that kind of attack.
And so you've got a paper that's coming out, being published?
That one, yeah, the steganography paper is in preparation right now.
Okay, this is quite exciting.
For me, yeah.
Long. Yeah, well.
Thank you.
For all of us who have the Google Glass lying in the drawer somewhere. So.
I know. That's where ours lays most of the time.
All right. We're all on this together. Thank you, Dr. Laszlo, for taking time to be with us today.
And thank you so much for having me.
And good luck. That was quite interesting. Sarah Laszlo is assistant professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Binghamton. or as they like to say, Binghamton University. That's about all the time we have for today. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And on the web this week, did you know that the U.S. has a chief data scientist, the first one ever? And we talked with the head honcho himself, DJ Patil. Check him out at sciencefriday.com/data scientist. You can email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. Happy Passover if you're celebrating. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.